When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hi, welcome to the Football Writers Podcast. My name is Mike Calvin. I'm joined by Dominic Fifield of The Guardian and Miguel Delaney of The Independent. Talk about first world problems. Premier League clubs are complaining they're being held to ransom in the transfer market. Poor lambs. It's their own fault. English football is squandering its inheritance, a predictable consequence of greed and panic. Surprised, Dom?
Not surprised that the prices are inflated for English clubs, because the world knows that English clubs get ridiculous amounts of money from big media companies. Where are we? But the reality is that everybody knows that they can charge English clubs a premium. When you look at the size of some of the deals, it does blow your mind, but I just think that's the market you're competing in. It's now, when you see a £7.5 million or even a £10 million transfer, you think that club's got a bargain, or there's something wrong with the player they're buying. It's got to that levels now, and we're at what Real Madrid pay, but we're paying it for relatively mediocre players.
It almost feels like 40 million is the standard price now. That's kind of your baseline figure for someone. Anyway, half decent. But there's probably almost an economic thesis in it, and that's just all this money. And obviously, it's so advertised how much money they have, but it hasn't actually made it any easier to buy players. It's just kind of made it different, almost made the market tougher. And even kind of, I was talking to someone at a club last week doing a piece on this, and they said they've never known a window like it in terms of just how difficult they found every single foreign club to deal with.
Well, that's understandable, isn't it? Because I think it's understandable that European clubs, they've got quite a sane market between themselves, haven't they? But the moment an English club turns up, it just goes haywire.
Well, it's interesting in that sense, because you can see it with Juventus and Bayern did a deal last week for Douglas Costa. Mm. And it's quite a low-key deal. It's a one-year loan, and the fee, I think, kind of amount to 40 million if Juventus decide to buy. But A, it's the sort of deal that they probably never allow an English club just because they want the money. And B, it does feel as if a little bit kind of almost all these kind of major foreign clubs are almost kind of operating a different market themselves apart from England. And even Agnelli at Juventus, he's dropped a few kind of hints lately about how it's time to maybe redistribute some of the money in the Champions League to get some of the Celtics and the Ajax and make them stronger again. So it does feel maybe there's a little bit of a shift in that way.
There's a more sophistication in that European market. Let's look at Renato Sanchez. I can't believe an English club hasn't gone in for him. AC Milan are looking at a two-year loan deal for €7.5 million with a view to buy for 40. That's a bargain in today's market, isn't it?
Yeah, but as we were saying off air beforehand, if a Chelsea had come in, it would have been £15 million a year with a view to buy for £70 million. So it's that ludicrous. There is a more sensible market in Europe before an English club gets involved in any deal. But you know, it wasn't like that. If Real Madrid came in for one of your players, you used to slap £20 million on top of the transfer fee. You do that with every English club now, and the top, the elite, the top four or five, maybe six, can afford to go and pay £40 million for a midfielder from France who's maybe got two or three caps. But what happens to a mid-table club in the Premier League or a club that's just been promoted? Do they risk blowing everything? And a lot of these clubs haven't received the money yet from the TV deals. That's for future pay. So they're mortgaging basically what they're going to get for the season. And I think the dilemma is for those mid-table teams, for your Stoke Cities. I mean, does Stoke City sanction a £22 million sale of Arnautovic to West Ham? Because they'll know that whoever they buy in, it's probably going to be £25 million for an incoming player of that calibre. So that's where the dilemma is, not with the elite, I don't think. Mm.
Some stats for you. Jerome Boateng, Mats Hummels, David Alaba, Josh Kimmich. £48.58 million. Kyle Walker, with the Daniel Levy tax thrown in, £53 million. Discuss.
Yeah, points to what Dom is saying as well, and kind of just how... I mean, it's almost a hyper-real market, the Premier League, at this point. But in that, actually, I think Tottenham have probably been one of the few clubs to almost resist this, but virtually, like, I mean, they've been chasing Lamar this summer. There's been talk that his wages should be £100,000. But they don't want to actually pay it just because of how disruptive it would be to the team. So, for a variety of reasons, mostly, I suppose, Levy's business sense, they have been extremely reluctant almost to indulge this inflation. Although, again, you'd wonder how much they also got burnt, given last summer their two big boys turned out to be, well, Janssen had that one moment against Swansea and Sissoko. I can't remember anything.
One moment against Swansea. Sissoko just didn't work at all. And the last time that Spurs spent big was the bail money.
Yeah, yeah.
Part of that. And that was a disaster, barring Ericsson.
That was the only
one that worked. Mm.
But the one thing about, I suppose, even with Bayern there, Hummels was probably the standout player in terms of who they signed. But that kind of came from a unique situation as well, kind of related to their power over German football. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it was a similar situation we've seen with Dortmund so often, where it was either basically sell a player or... Wait for him to leave. And I mean, that's damaging in itself in another way.
Mm. With City, one, do you think that they had to pay that money for Walker in the end, especially when Dani Alves went to PSG?
Yeah.
Get the title or bust?
Yeah, there's got to be an improvement on last year. Last year was a bit of an anticlimax, really, all things considered, given the build-up we'd given to Pep. And I think City fans expected, and the board expected from him. At least he's addressing areas of the team that we knew were problems. And the full-backs, it would be interesting to see whether they follow up their interest in Mondi as well at Monaco, because the prices being talked about on him are ridiculous. For a player that in France... people acknowledge has amazing days but also has pretty awful days as well.
Very pointedly tweeted this morning a picture of him at the Monaco training ground. I think that's what we call a come and get me play, isn't it?
I was looking Bakayoko's tweets at Monaco last week, and I think Monaco got a bit annoyed with him in the end with what he was putting out there. But I mean, you could write reams on these tweets alone from the players and reading into them, reading between the lines. Mondi, I think that would be a risk, bringing him in personally, but then City have got the money to throw at players like that, to be honest.
But Monaco are an interesting example in that. I mean, everyone expected a raid, and like, okay, they might well end up losing 5 to 7 players, but they're not exactly going for small prices. I mean, they've already started to kind of reinvest that expected money with some kind of clever signings like Tielemans.
Their biggest loss could well be the sporting director who left in the summer, so... But they are sort of seen as the model now, a club that raids South America, for example, and brings out the, you know, players of potential that they can sell on to gullible English clubs for a lot of money.
What do you make of the Sergio Aguero situation, Migs? Because, you know, we're hearing, you know, potential swap deal with Arsenal for Alexis Sanchez, Chelsea being mentioned in dispatches. I can't for the life of me see why they would let him go, but what do you feel?
Well, I mean, I suppose the one reason they could feasibly let him go is because there's been kind of this strange situation where Guardiola's used him and some of the comments and all that. But in saying that, when a tweet came out yesterday by a Spanish journalist, Manu Science, who's very, very good on stuff like Ronaldo stories, so obviously has a good connection to the Mendes camp. I just asked someone I know at City, and they said they've heard Aguero's not for sale at any price, and particularly not to a Premier League club, which would make sense even if Guardiola isn't that set them. I think there are some, they're still anticipate that eventually what Aguero will do is probably go back to Independiente once he finishes with City. But maybe more interesting is why that, I mean, if it is the case that City won't sell, Why is that? That information's been leaked out there. What's the kind of the goal behind that?
Give the listeners and viewers an insight into the machinations behind a big transfer. You know, the briefings, the word behind the hand, and all that stuff.
Well, I think it's all. I mean, when you do something on when you do a transfer story, you put it out on social media. It is always interesting to see people. Well, usually you get a lot of you've made this up. But even with the others who kind of they try and guess basically where has that come from, who's leaked that, and to be honest, as Dom I'm sure will say himself, it can come from any number of places. I mean, obviously there are many cases when clubs themselves just when a deal is close that they'll give kind of strategic amounts of info just to keep the journalists updated, but it can come from player sides, from people collect flow from kind of sponsors, from I think the range of potential sources is probably underappreciated. Maybe
I have to say that, and this is just speaking personally, the job journalistically dealing with transfers has never been harder. This summer in particular, it's ratcheted up another level with people attempting to feed you information. Yeah. Which some of which is so clearly bogus or loaded for a reason, which you just have to try and negotiate this passage between the political motivations of all these parties, and it's harder than ever. It's harder than ever to try and be accurate out there,
because it's all a game of spin from those leaking as well. Just because everyone, I mean, you can see it with some of the big transfers already this summer. Those who lose and those who win want to make sure they look as good as possible, and obviously kind of influence situations. But also, I mean, obviously, reporting a transfer is completely trivial compared to other areas of journalism. But I actually struggle to think of other areas of journalism where you have to cover on something like that as potentially volatile as a transfer as a transfer story, because even if it's interest, even if it should happen, even everyone thinks it will happen, so much can still go wrong, so much can still be distorted, and so much can end up making you looking very foolish, even if you were reporting the situation honestly at that time.
Mm. What about the City model, Dom? You know, you've got Douglas Luiz, €12 million from Vasco in Brazil, immediately shipped over to Girona. You know, basically, they're stocking another club at City. You've got Denier complaining that he'd sorted out his move to Lyon and they want him to go to Girona instead. Mm-hmm. Where is all that leading?
I'm a bit uncomfortable with it, just in the same way that I am with Chelsea and Vitesse. It's Breda as well with City, I think, in Holland, who just got promoted. But it's linked in with this desire to offer your younger players or the promising players that you've shipped in first team football somewhere, knowing full well you're not going to be able to offer it at your parent club. So, I mean, going to Chelsea, a club that I cover a lot more than City, I think I'm fair in saying that there's a lot of frustration this summer, more than I've ever known before, with the number of players that they're letting go, either on loan or losing, like Nacho Loba, 97 England caps at various junior levels, and now gets sold for £5.5 million to Watford. And in the meantime, they're getting linked with £60 million left backs or £50 million right backs. When you're thinking, well, hold on, you've got players you've been developing in your youth structure and have been playing first team football out on loan, who might be worth looking at, might be worth having a look in your first team. Otherwise, what's the point of them being at this club in the first
place? Well, that is the point. What is the point about spending, you know, City £200 million on their academy infrastructure? Mm. What's the point?
But we know both clubs are kind of almost obsessed now with bringing through with having that academy tradition. And yet it's like they do every single thing right to get to that point, except the one crucial thing, which is actually it was something that Pochettino spoke about two seasons ago. He said, when you're bringing a young player through, you have to show that initial trust. It's not about the first 10 minutes, the first game. You actually got to give them a proper run to kind of to breathe. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the ultimate difference between what's happened at Spurs and clubs like City and Chelsea. It's like, because some even with Chalobah, he's been brought on for 2-3 minutes at a time. Mm-hmm. And I mean,
one start last season in the Premier League, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. That was once to see the title had been won, I think. Yeah. Wasn't that one?
And that was hailed as a great breakthrough, where he and Loftus-Cheek were included in the first team.
I'll tell you what, there's a quote during the rounds from John Terry, when he's explaining why he decided not to sign a new one-year contract at Chelsea. And he said the last thing he wanted was to stunt the development of Nathan Ake, sold to Bournemouth, Kurt Zouma, about to be loaned to Stoke, Nat Chalobah sold to Watford. He's gone thinking that those guys were going to come through and make their mark at Chelsea, and they're not.
Mm. That does beg the question. You know, we've talked up England's success at youth level across the summer. You know, the under-19s winning the Euros at the weekend. What's the future for those boys? The talent's there. Where's the opportunity?
Well, on that, I mean, Ruben Loftus-Cheek was mentioned there. And I suppose he's maybe a similar age profile. They're not completely the same age, but similar to Dele Alli. One has come through one of the elite academies. The other dropped down, got from the age of what, from late teens, getting proper competitive football, and has made a quantum leap in terms of his development. And you do, like, is the academy system maybe failing in that way? That it's, we'll see more and more players, the ones who actually make the breakthrough, drop down quicker to get proper and become more rounded players.
Mm. We'll find out about Loftus-Cheek at Palace, won't we, this season?
We might do. I mean, he's we might do. I hope we do in some ways, but then I'm also conscious of the fact that he's potentially gone there to compete with the club captain, Jason Puncheon, for the same position. So are we likely to see him every week? Well, we'll see. I mean, Chelsea fans will argue that he's got more quality than Jason Puncheon, but Jason Puncheon's probably got 300 more senior games than that Loftus-Cheek. We'll see. That goes, I think it's tied in with ECCC, which has undoubtedly, I think we're in a position now to say that it has improved the quality of the best academy players, but it's also ensured that those players are developing at the best, the elite clubs, and they're not going to get a look in at any of those clubs. Mm. If those guys had been allowed to maintain their progress at the Fulhams, at the Palaces or Southamptons, whatever. I mean, Southampton's actually a bad example to use, but maybe they would be playing in the first team football more regularly. I think out of the under-19s that have just won the Euros, the only three players that were playing regular first team football last year were Sessegnon at Fulham.
Yeah.
I think Dizel played 9 games for Ipswich, and Zip Brereton at Forest. And other than that, everybody's just stuck in the system.
And to take your point about Chelsea, you know, I saw quite a bit of that under-19 team. Dujon Sterling,
excellent.
Looks a player. Mount, great number 10.
Raving about Mount. Yeah.
Where can they play?
Well, Mount will go to Vitesse, I would imagine. I think he will probably spend the season there. Sterling might push a loan as well somewhere else. Charlton were mentioned for De Silva, I think it's a captain. But that is what we're looking at. We're looking at them playing elsewhere. They're not playing at Chelsea.
It's an interesting thing as well. It wasn't one of the initial arguments that why they send them to Vitesse and not lower league clubs is because they feel that that level of football is more suited to what Chelsea would want. But it does feel like, even some of the players we've mentioned, that the opposite is now becoming true again. That's actually, it could be better for them to stay in England than and go lower down. Given even with Chelsea, the amount of players have gone to Vitesse and then not progressed.
Mm. Reality of Chelsea, Aubameyang, 31 goals in the Bundesliga last season, big transfer in the making.
Yeah, I'm quite surprised that he's been linked with Chelsea, but then again, he's been linked with everybody, and Dortmund have sort of set this deadline of the 24th of July to sort his future out. Again, it might be just me instincts, and they might be wrong, but I'm slightly suspicious of a player that is linked with as many clubs as he is, and this makes me wonder whether there's an active agent there that is trying to either push for a new deal or push for a more favourable move, maybe possibly to another German club. Chelsea sort of came out of the blue on that one, and I'm yet to be convinced that he will be the one they go for. Look, they might be proved wrong, because I think it goes with what the market is and whether they can get Morata in now, having missed out on Lukaku.
Yeah, but on that as well, I mean, Aubameyang's, first of all, I suppose Morata and Lukaku aren't that similar, but they're both kind of target men in the way that Conte wanted. But Aubameyang is completely different to that. Mm. So it will be kind of a
scattergun, isn't it?
Really? Yeah.
If they are indeed in for him. Mm.
There was a report that Higuain was mentioned as well. Can't see that happening, can you?
No, well,
I wouldn't have thought that would happen, no, personally. But I think they are in a position now with Chelsea. I know they're rewriting history slightly, but Chelsea were pursuing Lukaku, and that was their main man. And for whatever reason, they dawdled on it and they took their eyes off the ball and lost him to United.
You know that club very well. What's your take on the mood? What's the mood music like there?
I think we have to judge where they're at on September the 1st. Mm. I think it's too early now, because they can still make a success for the window, albeit at great expense, but they can still make a success for the window. I think there's been a lot of tension behind the scenes. I don't think Conte's been impressed with how they've dealt with things and how they've capitalised on the title success, just in the same ways as they failed to build on their previous two title successes. You know, the second season under Ancelotti was an unprecedented disaster. They panicked in January in the end and spent lots of money on an unfit Torres and David Luiz. Second time, and with Jose, you know, we all saw what happened in 2015. It was just, and how it unravelled so quickly the following season, when really their only major addition was Pedro. They just haven't reacted, and maybe that's because the market haven't been able to react in the way they want. But their first choices haven't come off as yet. Maybe they will still make a success of it.
But it's all the more surprising, given that this was a club for about 4 to 5 years. Was almost seen as one of the slickest in doing business, and they had this capacity to just always get these deals over the line.
Yeah, weirdly, I was, and this is probably my own fault as well. But I was starting to scheme down a piece about how Marina Granovskaya is the ultimate business negotiator in the market, and then Lukaku just completely fell through. And you think, well, actually, we're not in that position yet.
Because the Bakayoko deal, they eventually got it over the line, but not before there was all sorts of mayhem with conflicting agents and everything else, which is a very modern sort of morality play, isn't it?
And the world's longest ever trip to a medical.
Well, I mean, he has got an EMP issue, and I think Kia Jurabchin's involvement in some way in that deal probably meant it was likely to happen in the end to Chelsea. His brother, I think, was acting as his agent prior to that, and whether he's still involved in some capacity. And the knee injury was the issue, but then you do get unnerved. And again, all these reports suddenly came out last week that United were going to hijack it. And United were denying it throughout. But on some level, somebody somewhere was saying, well, be careful, because United could do this again.
So
then with Lukaku.
What about Danilo? The talk about him coming from Real Madrid, but then City have also mentioned in dispatches.
Yeah. What's interesting also, that Chelsea seem to be kind of front-loading loads of just very fast wide players as well. there's a few other areas they need.
Do you think Bakayoko would work well with Kante?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I mean, Matic wasn't always a kind of perfect fit last season. There was a few times, as good as Chelsea were, it did look a little bit awkward. Maybe Bakayoko is better suited. And also, it'll give... there was this whole debate was last season about whether Chelsea were a counter-attacking team and all that. And they probably were... Well, that's true or not. They probably were slightly more withdrawn than the kind of high-energy aggression that kind of on the front foot that Conte really does like. And I think Bakayoko will help in that regard.
Looks like, well, they won't sell Matic to Man United at any price. Do you expect them to go to Italy?
Yeah, I think probably Juventus would be the obvious choice, particularly given they're still talking, those clubs, over Sandro. It's a natural dialogue to sort of tag on the end of those talks. And if they get £40 million for Nemanja Matic, then, you know, fair play, well done. And they're still trying to make up the money they lost after selling him for a pittance first time round. So it's a strange one, that, as well, because that does actually leave them looking for another midfielder. And then last week they've let Chaloba go to Watford for 5.5. And Chaloba, I think, 4 months younger than Bakayoko, or older? Younger.
Younger, isn't it? Yeah.
It's a funny... They're playing a funny game, and I'm sort of... I don't want to launch two-footed in on them, because they have got this period that they can... They've got six weeks yet to make a success of it all. And let's see how balanced the squad is and how deep it is on the 1st, 2nd of September.
From the outside, though, you would just say it does just seem slightly counterintuitive to let so many players go before you get them in.
And I can only assume that either Conte is adamant these guys aren't going to make it, or they've got things lined up and they will...
What's your take on Manchester United? Mourinho saying he's basically halfway through his recruitment this summer. Who do you see coming in?
Perisic should be done this week, I think. He does still want Fabinho as a right back. I think they see that as somewhat difficult to do. And there's been growing talk about some mystery marquee name that Woodward still wants to bring in. Who that is, you know, but there's a lot of kind of a bubbling under the surface. Because there is kind of a renewed bullishness about United as well. I think that's only been kind of propelled by the fact that they took Lukaku off Chelsea. I mean, in general, the one thing from last season, and maybe from the general development of his career, I would have some reservations about whether Mourinho is still kind of the peak manager in the business, whether he's quite at the level of Pochettino and Conte now, when he, obviously 2-3 years ago, 5 years ago, he was undeniably the best in the world. But at the same time, I do think, I almost liken this kind of summer maybe to Inter 2009 or maybe Chelsea 2014, because he can clearly see exactly what types of players he needs. That's why he's been so intense on Perisic, why he's been so intense on a specific type of striker.
Well, Perisic would just supply the crosses for Lukaku,
yeah,
surely.
Yeah, exactly. Right? And if like, and it was one of the things about that, his last title win, I suppose, you could just see straight, once he got the signing, the team immediately fit together so well. And I think that is possible at United now, which is why they could, you know, they could potentially jump from six to actually a proper title challenge this time. But then, like with City, they need to.
Mm. Zlatan, there is some talk that he still might stay, will be offered another deal. You're Ed Woodward. Do you offer it?
I might do in January. Offer him 6 months in January.
It would be a marketing deal, wouldn't it?
It would, to be honest. I can't imagine. Well, look, I suppose we're assuming that Lukaku hits the ground running in that. But I do think that Lukaku would offer... I know he's criticised and his first touch is still very much under scrutiny, but I think he'll probably offer United a bit more, well, certainly a lot more movement across that front line. And Ibrahimovic, as wonderfully well as he did last season, has to be the focal point of everything. He has to be the main man. But, you know, 6 months and then allow him to go to the States or whatever he wanted to do subsequently, I think would work.
So the other big one I missed out there, obviously, that, you know, he's more than anything, he's desperate for a defensive midfielder, someone he's kind of to pin that team together. And actually, that could pose a little bit of difficulty because Dyer... Spurs have been adamant they're not going to sell, though some people close to United think that for 50 million they could get him, although I'd heard that their United's opening offer was about 23.5 million, which is some way short, especially to Levy. So Matic looks off the agenda now, although I do wonder whether they'll go back in one more time. But as you say, there's
no way they'd do that because of the egos of the boardroom.
So after that, then suddenly, I mean, Nottingham was mentioned with Roma Montsell, and also he doesn't feel like a traditional defensive midfielder anymore in the way that Dyer and Matic are. So then if it is such a key position, they're suddenly looking at maybe a slight bit of difficulty in who they can get in there. Weigl's been mentioned from Dortmund as well, though he's obviously young. That could be one of the most interesting areas of United summer now, what he does at that position, or then whether he improvises again and he puts Blind there or puts Herrera there. But that's obviously not what Mourinho wants, and his reaction to that, if he doesn't get a defensive midfielder, could also be
interesting.
Yeah.
Let's look at Liverpool, and Jurgen Klopp's been talking about expecting a new car, which would presumably have two legs rather than four tyres. They're holding out to try and get Keita. Virgil van Dijk, given everything that's happened, will they get him?
It would take Virgil van Dijk to agitate to an extent that modern footballers don't seem to ever do, as in handing in transfer requests. What I'm not going to take my bonus. Well, if he does, then that puts Southampton, the pressure on Southampton, and then it's who offers the most money. I wonder whether a market would suddenly open if Virgil van Dijk handed in that transfer request. I think you might see Chelsea maybe flexing their muscles again on that front. I mean, Liverpool will find themselves in a position where the two players that they want will cost an arm and a leg. And if they get them, then that's £130 million spent on two players. And I know that Fenway want to spend big this summer, and they've made it obvious they'll do that. And it's going to be a game of patience with them, because at the moment they just see Everton spending £100 million next to them, albeit recouping most of that with Lukaku. But they're going to have to be patient right up to the deadline, I imagine.
Does Everton's activity put extra pressure on them?
Also, I said, giving away the table finish puts extra pressure on United, but obviously United aren't their local rivals, and Arsenal as well, because Everton... I mean, I think with Everton signings, there's still a few that you would think, right, they're good signings, but will they really make a top-four side? Mm. But then I suppose with the point they're at, it's all about kind of incremental progress, maybe like City, when they first got their money... even if it's not quite exactly the same situation.
But Merseyside football is a febrile place, and if Everton are perceived to be advancing and improving, and Liverpool don't get their men, that will impose a certain strain.
Oh, completely, yeah. And it does create a mood.
Well, the only thing I'd say is that if Everton have made all their signings and kept Lukaku, then definitely.
Yeah.
Then you're thinking, whoa, they're really going places. But the fact is that they've sold somebody who scores 20-odd goals. Mm. And we don't know quite... And they obviously need to... They need another forward in. And hence all those links last week with people like... Benteke and Dzeko, yeah. Mm.
What about the importance of Jordan Henderson? I thought they missed him last season towards the end. Almost the whole cliche, isn't it? You know, like having a new signing. A big season for him?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Especially if he was given his leadership role in the team as well. Then ahead of a World Cup. It's interesting, for all we're talking about English players, and yet two of the most important to Klopp, one of the most esteemed continental coaches, are two of the most important, the way he plays and particularly the way he runs, are actually two English players in Lallana and Henderson. Mm-hmm. Because I think they're both so crucial in setting the pace of that Liverpool side. And when one of them isn't there, it does feel as if kind of there's just a little bit of a disconnect with the squad, because given how base they are on that thrust.
Mm, they brought in Andy Robertson from Hull. Is that just basically padding out the squad, or do you think he'll challenge for a first team place?
I liked him in a Hull team that was had a very different kind of objective. He's good going forward, great going forward, left wing back role. Defensively, I think he's very suspect. Mm. Bit harsh, I know, but he's, you know.
Sounds like the usual Liverpool left back, doesn't it?
That's a bit harsh. Yes.
With Everton, you know, they've been linked with Mario Lemina from Juventus, the Gabon international. That, again, to me, sounds like someone's trying to create a market for a player like that. The last thing they need is another midfield player, is it?
And that's probably the problem as well, when suddenly you do spend money. I mean, as we mentioned about all of this, if it's very obvious you can spend and want to spend, then suddenly, A, the price you're quoted is always much higher, but B, you suddenly become a convenient almost lightning rod for any other deal. You know, if anyone goes, well, you know,
it's always West Ham are interested,
yeah,
as well.
Exactly. Although it's interesting, West Ham after going so nuts in the transfer market last season, they've been actually comparatively quiet this year, and despite it being on the brink of a few moves.
Mm. With the situation at Everton, you've got what basically is bullying going on, isn't it? Let's be honest about it, with Gylfi Sigurdsson. £50 million, come to us. Swansea talking darkly about alleged tapping up. Now, this is a familiar story for you. Is there any way around that? If a player wants to go, he'll go.
It never has been any way around it, has there? Absolutely. If a player makes up his mind that he wants out, he gets his move eventually. You know, it can be a painful process. A messy divorce, but ultimately that's what tends to happen. Albeit that these days the added thing is sometimes you get the odd player that hands in a transfer request, doesn't want to be there, and then suddenly signs a new contract on the quiet. there have been a few of those of late. Dale Stevens at Brighton rings a bell. This time last year he was asking for a transfer, and now he's preparing for a Premier League campaign with them. But it's all politics, and I suspect that Sigurdsson ultimately will end up at Goodison.
Well, just thinking as well on that, I mean, obviously the reason that clubs and managers ultimately let these players go is because they realise that one of the difficulties of having someone that doesn't want to be there around and all the potential problems. But even in recent years, there's actually been cases of players that when clubs have put the foot down, they've stayed, and it's actually worked out well for them.
Yeah, I guess so. Rooney, every year, you know.
Well, yeah, that's just true, actually. Yeah, a little bit. I mean, to a degree, maybe De Gea, although I suppose that only fell down because of it wasn't exactly United put their foot down. It was.
with De Gea, do you think he will eventually go to Madrid? You know, because Real Madrid, let's face it, are a bit like the Mounties. They always get their man in the end, don't they?
It probably will eventually happen at some point. Whether it happens this summer, I'm not sure. Although the kind of intrigue behind that has been so odd, that situation. Especially like it was the first week of June when suddenly you saw these kind of very pointed stories in Spanish media, you know, almost the kind of the equivalent of what we've seen the last week from United, from English media with United, but that Real suddenly are no longer interested in De Gea, and Zidane has made it clear Navas is number one. Mm. Yet despite that, it's never really gone away. United, as we know, are still kind of it's always lingered there, this threat of Real coming back in. I think, you know, again, in keeping with the bullishness we talked about United, they don't see why they would have to sell De Gea. I think if it did come to it, they would almost nearly, they don't need the money, so they would almost go to Real. Well, if you want them that badly, what are you willing to offer in return? Potentially one of their proper stars.
Isco or a Tony Cruz or something.
A Tony Cruz. So it would be interesting if it did get to that point. But I think another reason United are relaxed as well, I mean, obviously they want De Gea to stay, and would prefer to say, but Mourinho does like both his current goalkeepers. I think he really respects and values Romero's contribution.
Just signed a four-year contract.
But also Pereira is seen as some of United think he's potentially better than De Gea. Now, whether that's a little bit of spin, who knows, but he is really, really highly rated. And I think if they're to lose De Gea in the medium term, I'd say that could almost be ideal if they are that serious about Pereira, because he is really seen as the future in net.
Mm. Doesn't seem to be that long ago that Jack Wilshere was the future. Is he the past at Arsenal?
I fear he may be. The noise is coming out from... Where are they now? They're in Australia now, aren't they? From Wenger, where he probably will be at Arsenal this season. Unfortunately, the injuries have just taken their toll on him. And I don't think he actually... Although you get very nice, kind words from Eddie Howe throughout last season, but I never really got the impression that he illuminated the place in the way that Eddie Howe thought he might, which is a great shame. And I think it's, again, just the injury just taking the gloss off it slightly, taking the edge off his play. I mean, he played regularly for them, so he's got that behind. He can't sort of fall back and say, you know, I'd had another injury or interrupted season. He pretty much played most games, or part in most games, and I just don't see where he slots into the Arsenal midfield anymore.
I think you might have been out as well when Chelsea beat Bournemouth down in April, and Wilshere had quite a decent game, played some lovely passes in it. And afterwards, in the Monday's section of the press conference, he was asked a few times about Wilshere, and it was kind of almost this restrained compliment. He was talking, the nice pass, but he wasn't really willing to gush about him, maybe the way some of the questions wanted.
We know about the injury issues. There's always in the background attitude issues or potential attitude issues. I found it really interesting that Alexi Iwobi basically admitted that he wasn't hungry enough last season. Does that encapsulate Arsenal's problem?
The impression, I think, that's always given off Arsenal, and one of the kind of wider issues of Wenger at this point, is that it does sometimes, from what you hear, it feels like the sort of... even last season, there were never any indications that any of the players wanted Wenger to go. And I think sometimes it does feel like it's like one of those classrooms where everyone likes the teacher, everyone respects him, but then when it comes to exam time, you kind of wonder, are we as ready as we should? They could have done with something harder. Because, the feeling of Arsenal is that it's a club where players are maybe more indulged than they should be. And while that is good to a point, and with a certain type of character, has obviously worked very, very well for Wenger, particularly when he first came, it does allow a certain amount of... Slacking off is the wrong word, maybe a bit harsh, but it doesn't mean the hardness isn't there. The real
comfort
kind of...
Comfort zone.
Yeah.
Comfort zone. And it has been for a while.
Mm.
And you're looking for them to shake it up somehow.
Yeah.
And the greatest respect, I don't think spending £46 million up front on Alexandre Lacazette is going to shake it up.
Yeah.
It might make a difference at the top end, but I still think the underlying issues will be there at Arsenal. Mm.
Where do you think Giroud will end up? Dortmund have been mentioned, haven't they?
Yeah. I think... Well, actually, I think Arsenal should try and keep him, to be honest. I think he would be he would always be that slightly different type of striker that would add to their resources up front. But if he is going to leave, Marseille are throwing some money around. If he can... I mean, they've actually bought quite impressively, I think, this season, this summer.
Taking the G back off Spurs as well.
Yeah, he's gone over there, hasn't he? And Mandanda's gone back. And there's a solidity about it. That's a club that's... under new ownership and are being ambitious and are trying to sort of break in at duopoly at the top between Monaco and PSG. I think that might get his juices flowing going back there to the south of France, where he enjoyed that wonderful season at Montpellier when they won the league.
We're in now World Cup season. is important for any player now to actually show himself in his best light. Joe Hart, having his medical at West Ham today, Monday, he needs a stellar season, doesn't he?
Yeah, completely, especially the way last season ended, and the way even Selkirk was talking about him and those last two games around the England and French and French friendly. Just to quote, on England, though, just to go back, actually, from that Scottish game, it was the one thing I was thinking throughout, and it's so relevant to Wilshire. I think the one thing that England team is missing above anything is that midfield pass from the middle. I mean, because there are genuinely so many good players dotted around that squad, that team, that squad, but they just miss something to link it together. And it makes it all the more of a pity that Wilshire is not ready for it, or it doesn't look like he will be that player. But so much depends on the season. But yeah, I think it's not the same with Hart, obviously, but he does need to kind of re-establish his clout.
He's got them, and there's competition there, isn't there now?
Mm,
yeah. It wasn't before. Then now he's suddenly got four people with Heaton as well. Pickford doing well, Forster's doing well, Buckland's back. They're all competing for that place. And
I can see Pickford and Buckland being the two.
I think Buckland's got so many admirers within the England setup. Mm. We saw he comes back in the French game for the second half, and he came on at half time. And they obviously think that this is a kid that's going to go places. And the injury was so unfortunate, what happened with him, and it was 15 months or longer out after the Germany match. And I think he's the one they look at and think, well, he really could be a first choice come 4 or 5 years down the line.
Mm. With England, do you expect... we talked a lot about young players earlier on. If you had to identify one player who could break into that squad, young player, who would it be?
What do you mean by young now? Is 20 young?
Yeah.
This is it. Chalob, actually.
Yeah, there you go.
He's especially given Southgate has made it clear to me, if you get regular football, you're in serious consideration because we need someone in that position.
Mm. He's gone back to the right place as well. He knows Watford, doesn't he?
Yeah, and he played something like 3,200 minutes of football in the Championship as an 18-year-old with Watford, which is almost unprecedented these days. The right fit. I mean, look, Watford is very different now, and it's very different every season with terms of the squad. But you'd think that Marcus Silva would tap into that quality. It's quite exciting, actually, with Will Hughes in there as well, and the balance they could get in that midfield. That is exciting, and there is promise there. Chalobah, I like to see how Loftus-Cheek does as well, because people at Chelsea think that he's an England player in the making, but as I say, he's untested.
Mm. Mm. Mm-hmm. Let's look finally at the Women's Euros. Now, there's a bit of mea culpa about this, because our business sometimes does not do itself any favours. There's a headline talking about the stunning babes of 2017 at the Euros. You know, that sort of sexist garbage belongs to the Stone Age. Is this the tournament where women's football is going to be taken with the seriousness it deserves?
Really, really hope so. And I'm you're right about that. That's just come from nowhere, because I think you'll actually find that in terms of Fleet Street, correspondents actually covering the tournament in Holland, probably more than ever, have gone over there with staff writers, filing, you know, features, news stories every single day. You've got a tournament where the opening fixture, you've got 21,000 sellout to see the Dutch. I think it beat Norway, didn't they, 1-0 on Sunday.
Germany, really good, the holders are starting. England,
Germany,
Scotland
Sweden's
on Tuesday.
England's, I think, it was Wednesday, isn't it? And it's just, it's a proper game. There's a lot of pressure on, you know, Mark Sampson's team to sort of maintain the success that English junior teams have had all summer, and now they go there suddenly as one of the favourites, and thinking that for the first time in ages we could have an England women's team that could dethrone the Germans, who are all conquering at this level.
In that regard, actually, the 2015 World Cup feels actually a little bit of like an Italia 90 in terms of the maybe the kind of the wider appreciation for women's football, just because just how much it seems like, I think, how much to capture people's attention. Suddenly the way it went from, as you say, kind of almost kind of being reported in the way kind of mid-size or niche leagues around Europe where it's actually suddenly been a properly covered kind of headline news. Mm. And again, we can already see the effects of that now.
But talking to an agent, he said the problem with the women's game at the moment is that the finances are pretty much concentrated on two or three clubs. Mm. You know, the usual suspects, Chelsea, City, Arsenal to a degree, where a player could earn maybe anywhere between £60,000 and £80,000 a year. You're at Liverpool, mm-hmm. you're on 22,000. That's the imbalance that women's football has got to get its head around, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Because you've got to get a much broader base.
Yeah, well, you do, right. But, I mean, we saw Lewis FC last week.
Yeah.
They're going to equal pay for its men's and women's teams. Sort of groundbreaking. It's a non-league club, but it's moving in the right direction. It's very early days still. Mm. Unfortunately, that's just the reality. Mm. It's in terms of the finances involved.
Yeah, also, there's a bit of a chicken and egg. This is ultimately it's the dilemma to a certain extent. But basically, so the more media attention it gets, the more interest will be created. The more people will flock to, the more supporters they get. And it is a slightly slow process in that sense as well. But it can happen.
But when you've got Tony Duggan going to Barcelona,
yeah.
That to me is a landmark move.
Yeah. I mean, even the kind of the image, like just the very mention of Barca, what that connotes, the glamour that it gives.
We
it all.
Had Paul Stretford but doing that deal with a photograph with Duggan with the Barcelona shirt, Stretford in the background, and then 2 days later he was at Everton with Wayne Rooney doing exactly the same pose, and that's promising. I think that's a sign that we are moving in the right direction slowly.
Well, just think. The FA banned women's football for 50 years until 1972. Mad, eh? Thanks for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.